welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And as regular listeners know, a few months ago, we set out a call for personal essays. The goal was to give anyone a chance to express their own thoughts and feelings. The only rules we imposed on the contest was that the essay had to be personal and it had to do something with Mormonism. I'm pleased to introduce the results to you tonight and let you hear the voice of these individuals for yourself. Putting yourself out there is not easy. It's not always easy to find the voice of what thoughts and feelings are inside or to express those in words. I think many people struggling with the church have found that there's a torrent of words and information and people talking and accusing and screaming and yelling and words and words and words and words. You get together with other liberal Mormons or ex-Mormons and the words just flow as people try to process these things that are happening to them. Religion is a complex thing. It gives us happiness. It sometimes confuses us. For some people, it's the greatest thing in their life, and for some people, it's the greatest source of sorrow. Let's begin tonight by hearing the words of Chris. Oftentimes, the ties that bind in the church run pretty deep through families and through experience. We put a lot on the line oftentimes when we join the church, and the sacrifices we make for our membership and for the things that come our way. Chris's experience illustrates that.
Like many of your listeners, I was born and raised Mormon. My family has played a very strong role in the establishment and development of the church in Bulgaria. My mother is a native of Bulgaria, and while fleeing from communism, was converted to Mormonism with all of her family while living in France. So strong was her conviction of the truth of the Mormon faith, she inevitably found herself attending BYU not long after being converted. It was there that she met my father in a clinic following a nasty brush with poison ivy he had had earlier that day. I believe my mother's roommate was a nurse of sorts in the clinic and tipped her off that there was a very cute guy that needed visitors. Some kind of thinly veiled attempt at a blind setup, you know the drill. Well, it worked. They got married a couple of months later in the temple, Provo, I believe, and went on to have 6 kids, of which I am the youngest. After a fun-filled romp in the countries of France, Portugal, the Azores, Brazil, and Germany, not particularly in that order, gaining more family members as each country passed, my father decided to retire as a U.S. Foreign Service officer. He settled for the far less glamorous and less adventurous career as a technical writer. Why would anyone decide to leave such a rich and fulfilling career to work as a technical writer for a software company? It so happens that the church my parents were so fond of issued a call to service to my mother. She was to teach Bulgarian at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah. The technical writing position that my father snatched up in a hurry was for WordPerfect, which was in the neighboring town of Orem. This was to become the city of my upbringing. I don't know all the details, but I can only imagine my mother as being a very vocal and outspoken advocate of the church, but more specifically the opening of her native Bulgaria to the preaching of the gospel. Over the years of service in the Mormon church, both she and my father had managed to make some friends in very high places within the church. This became evident as my mother was the one to single-handedly translate the Book of Mormon in its entirety from English to Bulgarian. It was also her father, Kirill, who ended up being the first mission president of the Bulgaria Sophia Mission. Or was it the Sophia Bulgaria Mission? Yeah, I forget. Now that you're somewhat aware of my family's recent history and significance in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I can get going on my apostasy. The idea that I would someday not be a member of the Mormon Church of my own free will would have certainly sounded absurd to me prior to April of 2009. I'm not saying I'd never imagined myself in that position many times previous, however. I've always let my mind wander in all things to very high degrees of absurdity. It was just in the case of being Mormon, I always wondered what it was like not being as lucky as I was, having the fullness of the gospel in my life. It always made me shudder and increased my resolve to do what is right. I was always active in church. For the majority of my life, a good chunk, if not the majority of my social network, was all encapsulated by church groups and activities. This is the kind of environment that I can't ever remember being without. Serving a mission was almost never an if statement, and that's what I ended up doing. I was called to serve in the Sweden-Stockholm mission. Looking back on it now, I can definitely say that I don't regret it. Ironically, my faith was probably the thing that was strengthened the least by my mission experience. If anything, my sense of empathy was the attribute that underwent a massive overhaul, as well as tolerance, of course. I did have a moment, just a moment, of existential crisis on my mission. It was in the little town of Katrineholm in the south of Stockholm, I believe. We had met someone who could only be described by his nickname, or rather the nickname that we gave him, Mystery American Muslim Man. He was indeed all of those things, quite the mystery how he thought, as well as an American. He had converted to Islam for some reason in the recent past, and while this is abundantly clear and in no need of further clarification, I'll state it for the sake of consistency. He was a man. I wish I remember what it was that he said to us, my companion and I just remember my thoughts dwelling on it the whole night. Whatever it was that he said, it made me come to a terrifying conclusion for a brief moment. I was completely stripped of all my mental safety nets, as well as the influence of my peers and family. It was just me for that brief moment. It was in that moment that I realized that I didn't know for certain of God's existence, and could probably never know either. It wasn't the time or the setting for this, however. I just wasn't ready. I put it on a shelf inside a safe and put that safe in the back of my mind. It wasn't until around March of 2009 that my faith was seriously called into question, for real. Not that the previous instance was any less real than this one. This one just led somewhere. The person that called it into question, it wasn't by any naysayer or wayward friend, but myself. This is where I truly ended up being quite lucky, because by this time I was married to my wife, of course, my wife Emma, who happened to be on the exact same level and going at the exact same pace as I was in this process. Basically, it started out with both of us starting to notice how we felt each Sunday as we came out of church and started walking home. We felt horrible. Not guilt horrible, just disgusted horrible. One day I turned to Emma and just flat out asked, "Do you feel bad coming out of church?" Nodding emphatically, she responded, "Yeah, it happens every Sunday now. I go in feeling all right and leave feeling awful." We talked more about it and came up with various theories on why the church was, or why church, was such a downer. We both came to the conclusion that it was the ward we were attending. It was overwhelmingly patriotic, and everyone, with a few exceptions, just seemed so mass-produced. We decided to try out a different ward in an earlier time slot. It was even worse. We even had friends that attended that ward. Isn't that supposed to make it better? We then started to think that we were the problem, or rather our testimonies. I can't speak as well for my wife at this point on. I can just say that she followed me into that rabbit hole, going down a steeper and steeper slope until it turned into a free fall. I should mention that this was the same time I started working at the Apple back-to-school rebate team at the local temp job center. The best part about it was that I wasn't on the phone team. Instead, I was on the team that digitized the rebate forms, so I could come in, sit down, and start working on a stack of envelopes while listening to music or an audiobook. I blazed through the first three books of the Enders series by Orson Scott Card, as well as a book that I couldn't have started at a better time, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. I found this book so intriguing that I then went on to listen to The End of Faith by Sam Harris. Those two books really got me thinking about my own beliefs and made me question how much of them were truly my own. From that point on, it didn't take me long to unravel my religious belief in its entirety. I had none. There were bits and pieces of Mormon doctrine that I really liked and clung to more than others, but for me, it's all or nothing. Honestly, though, the doctrine wasn't really what did it for me. The meat of the matter was that once I was able to remove myself mentally from Mormon society, from what I was born into, I understood that spiritual confirmations were based solely on feelings derived from emotion. Finally, I could look back on my brief crisis of faith I had had as a missionary and not only make sense of it, but not be afraid of it. I finally saw that, no, I don't like the idea of suspending my sense of logic and reason so as to contort my mind in such a way as to fill some sort of existential void that I'm obligated to have by being human, by believing the idea of a god. A god, while being very Bronze Age, is also quite modern. A god that is the same now and forever, except in cases of social evolution, then changes are necessary, of course. As well as the idea of an all-encompassing, literally all-encompassing, vicarious sacrifice that nobody could ever hope to understand. I can't help but think of the parable of the talents as explained by a church apostle. Of course, the correlation was so simple when I heard of it, when I heard it the first time, but my mind was conditioned so as to understand it that way I was supposed to understand from birth. I think of it now, and I truly can't see how these teachings are so widely considered moral. I guess what I wrote earlier about the doctrine not being the problem didn't turn out to be the case. The classic Christian doctrines are adopted by Mormon faith and taken so much further. They're pretty much taken as far as your imagination limits you to, or if you're of my persuasion, however much you can stomach. While it's still too early for me to be able to say I'm proud to have Mormon lineage and truly mean it, I still recognize, after the dust has settled a bit, that the Mormon faith does have many positive and uplifting messages and teachings that I still agree with. It also offers many people, in many cases, a healthy societal structure to participate in and gives their lives meaning. The trick now is to not go crazy and give in to cynicism and general intolerance. It'd be a shame to make it this far only to come full circle. Hey, there's a decent, sufficiently ambiguous Mormon principle. Moderation in all things.
Our second essay is provided by Andrew. Oftentimes, the experiences that we feel in relationship to the church are complicated and can be best expressed in metaphor. Here is Andrew's extended metaphor describing his view on the church and individuals' relationship to it.
Picture a huge rectangular block of ice, 70 stories tall, sitting in a wide plain in a mountainous region in the west central part of North America. Exactly how it got there is the subject of debate. Some say it was a divine act of nature. Others say man built it, adhering strictly to the laws of nature, and that it glorifies nature as a result. And still others say it was built by men for the most unnatural and vile purposes, that it defiles nature. The cold north winds of nature's winter seem to keep the ice block solid and perfect and gleaming. But there are seasons of warm sun and gentle breezes that melt drips and drops off the edges. The crisp, sharp edges disappear in places and morph into rounded and cloudy sections. Indentations, gaps, and even holes appear in places where warm breezes blow. The ice block is changing, and we can see the changes even from a great distance. In many ways, the ice block is not what it was in the past. When we get a little closer to the block of ice, we see workmen, almost all dressed in white shirts, scurrying about the base of the structure. And we even notice some workmen scaling the sides and on top of the large rectangular prism. These people seem actively engaged in some purpose. Some are attempting to repair imperfections. And when they manage to patch a small hole with new ice, they stand back and admire their work and claim, really, there was never any damage done at all. Nothing has ever changed. The block has always been perfectly rectangular. Some people are adding very cold water to the top and watching it freeze. They tell us they are building the largest, best, and most perfect glacier in all of nature. They know it will take time, but they are certain that with diligence, their 70-story ice cube can become a glacier spanning the entire globe. There are men assigned to tell us the story of the creation of the ice block, and others assigned to tell us of the importance of the ice block, and still others assigned to tell us of the future of the ice block. In their stories, they tell of men who have preceded them as storytellers and as workers, and they tell us of the great stories that have been told and of the great work the men have done in building the ice block. Upon closer examination, we notice that fully half, in some areas more than half, of the workers involved in building, repairing, and improving the ice block are women. The women are doing much the same work as the men, but always the men are in charge. The stories told by the storytellers rarely mention the women or their contribution. The work continues, sometimes furiously, but real progress is slow, even halting, and sometimes even the most energetic work cannot keep up with the natural melting actions. As we move about among the people working on the ice block, we see others who are nearly invisible at first due to their inactivity. They are the idlers along the periphery. Also nearly invisible are the bystanders who have found their way to the middle of activity, but although standing in the midst of the workers, contribute little or nothing toward the building of the ice block. The busy workers sometimes glare at the idlers, sometimes cajole them and attempt to get them involved in the work, but largely the workers ignore the idlers and go about their own work. The busy workers are mostly friendly with the bystanders, but sometimes uneasy about them. As we walk around the base of the ice block, we notice there are many crippled people, most who are former workers who have become injured. Some tell us they became so weary in their work they could no longer continue and fell. Some had various other accidental work injuries. Others say the work became so tedious and dreadful that they willingly jumped from their high places. Few of the workers on the ice block take any notice of their crippled former colleagues. Some actively criticize the crippled for getting in the way or for having been weak or ineffective in their jobs, saying that they deserve to be crippled. The crippled former workers seem to be organizing in small groups of like-minded people. They are helping each other to become healthy and well. Some are ignoring their former colleagues. Some are criticizing them. Some are trying to get their former colleagues to leave their ice block jobs. And some are trying to find a way to still share their lives with their friends and family who are actively engaged in the work of building the block of ice. Some of the former workers are filled with animosity and are actively chipping away at the edges of the ice block, attempting to injure or destroy the ice block. Some former workers are blowing hot air on the ice block. Some are calling on nature to transform the block, and some are trying to forget the ice block's existence. The ice block is many things to many people. Some people are drawn to it and worship the ice block as if the ice block itself was all of nature. Many of the workers think the ice block contains all the beauty that exists in nature. Some workers, however, see the ice block as a job and a way of life and nothing more. Some people hang around the periphery of the ice block, and some ignore the ice block and walk away, never looking back. What will become of this large block of ice, we cannot know exactly. We do know that some ice lasts for thousands of years, and some ice melts away and disappears completely. Most of us doubt this ice block will become the largest glacier in the world. We know that people will continue to be hurt while working to enlarge or repair it. We know nature's wind will occasionally seem to act to make it solid and pure, while at other times working to dissolve and destroy it. But we know most of all that nature brings about change, and that the ice block will change. This ice block is in our lives, and it is changing. Our actions, whatever they are, will affect the ice block, whether we choose to build it up, tear it down, watch it from a safe distance, or walk away from it entirely. Our actions will affect the ice block and all the workers, former workers, storytellers, bystanders, and idlers around it. Let us each consider our actions very carefully in connection to the large block of ice.
President of the church, David O. McKay, famously said, "No other success can compensate for failure in the home." Although this quote is probably a great motivator for many, it has a flip side. Since no other success can compensate for failure in the home, and success is defined in the home and in the gospel, For those parents who have children who leave the church, there can be no greater pain. Listen to Clay's essay discussing his relationship with his brothers and sisters to their parents as they go through this painful process.
My younger sister and brother are creative, dedicated, pensive, and enthusiastic people. More importantly, they are just good people. Unfortunately, during family get-togethers, the atmosphere is sometimes strained instead of joyful. You see, both my younger sister and brother decided to disassociate themselves from the LDS Church in their high school years and have since retained their disassociation. This creates a strange relationship between them and my parents. The tension is complex, and its nuances defy my descriptive skills. What is clear is that in the eyes of my parents, no accomplishments my siblings achieve will ever make up for the disappointment my parents feel for their children's apostasy. A disappointment that taints every family gathering. This disappointment is what prevents me from being fully transparent about my own apostasy. Perhaps in retrospect, my apostasy was a long time coming. As a teenager, I was in teacher's quorum, and the teacher decided to hold a spur-of-the-moment testimony meeting. We sat in a circle, and I listened as the other kids bore testimony of all the expected things. I was jittery, and was not excited for my turn to speak. When all eyes were on me, I nervously but steadily said that I didn't have a testimony in those expected things. I was then told by an attending bishopric member that he did not believe me. What? What do you mean you do not believe me? I said with obvious irritation. He replied with confidence and authority, I don't think that anyone can be raised in the church and not have any kind of testimony. I spent the rest of the meeting tamping my foot, furiously trying to tamp down my rage. In retrospect, I hope that my testimony of no testimony was fueled by some rational thought and was not only driven by teenage rebellion, the drugs from the night before, and my own prickish tendencies. Similarly, I hope that the time that I walked out of seminary after a heated altercation with my teacher about blacks and the priesthood was instigated by an ideal hidden inside me, and not just my iconoclasm run amok. Yet religious belief is so bizarre that not long afterward, I found myself the recipient of an earth-shattering, born-again experience. The church really was true. Maybe that old man in teacher's quorum was right, and I really did have a testimony all along. A spinning amalgam of faithful years followed that included a mission, religious zeal, temple marriage, and me towing the party line the best I knew how. Then it hit. For reasons familiar to so many, I felt my testimony being torn from my grasp. I came to a junction where I had to decide whether I would believe in the faith of my fathers no matter what, ignoring everything that was quickly becoming clear, or would I start exploring this treacherous path now in front of me? I decided to explore. My story is not unique. It isn't even special. It is common, too common. Post-apostasy tension piles up in communities and families amongst Christians, Muslims, Mormons, and I am sure all other religions that at times are more concerned with their images of the great hereafter than they are about enjoying the here and now. People speak about a deep feeling of liberation after letting go of belief. I have felt that sense of liberation many times, but the question that is now staring me down is whether or not I am willing to sit in front of many of my loved ones and be okay with knowing that no matter what I may achieve or have achieved, their disappointment runs deeper, tainting every family gathering.
In Mormonism, the testimony is an interaction of your feelings with the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit. To Mormonism, the Spirit is of paramount importance, more so than any sort of rational processing of the gospel or of the church. Listen to Cody's essay as he discusses the Spirit and thinks through the way that he processed those ideas and processes them now.
Is the Spirit a reliable tool to determine truth? The idea that one can pray regarding any aspect of Mormonism and receive a spiritual confirmation is central to LDS belief. Members are encouraged to not just rely on the faith of their family or friends, but to get their own answer by praying and receiving a feeling that it is true. This is commonly referred to as a burning in the bosom or listening to the still small voice, and basically includes any supernatural subjective experience as evidence that the church is true, or that you are receiving an answer to your prayer. Having been a missionary, I recall how heavily we relied on this teaching. Either by direction from my superiors or through observing other missionaries, I felt pressured to emphasize and embellish, or invent, my own spiritual confirmation story to relate to potential converts. Since I never had anything supernatural occur in response to a prayer, I attempted to be both honest and faith-promoting about the promise to have their prayers answered. We encouraged investigators to pray about what we had told them, and if they received a good feeling, then we instructed them to interpret that as the Holy Ghost testifying to them about the veracity of our message, and, in extension, that the Mormon Church was true. There is no doubt that this idea is a powerful tool to help people feel comfortable with either a difficult decision or a new idea. But is it a reliable method to determine objective truth? Since almost every religion professes spiritual confirmation to be a part of their belief, is the witness that Mormons receive any different than what others experience? While the idea is universal amongst Mormons, the way each person experiences it is unique. In the early days of the Mormon religion, powerful manifestations such as visions, speaking in tongues, and fainting were common, as it was with many of the revival participants of the day. Since that time, the experience has become much more personal and intimate than outwardly apparent. Most describe the experience as a warm sensation or thoughts or words coming to their mind. The experience may be personal, but it is still described as being very powerful, enough so that their conviction that they received an answer is solid. The truth is, however, that by having a completely subjective experience, there is no way to compare it to other experiences for validity. The experience is so vague and undefined that almost anything could be construed to constitute an answer. And yet, when it comes to other religions' version of the Spirit, many faithful LDS are skeptical. The speaking in tongues that occurs in certain religions, Christian sects, is a good example of perceived divine interaction, wholly believed by the participants, but which is almost entirely distrusted or dismissed by Mormon believers. The Mormon experience of spiritual confirmation is not unique, or even completely definable, except by what it isn't. The only way to know if the answer is from the Spirit is by what the answer is. If the answer is affirming to belief in the LDS Church, then the answer is from the Spirit, and vice versa. Are there any examples where the Spirit was wrong? Since the Church teaches us to be responsible investigators, it is important to look at any examples where the Spirit may have been wrong and understand why. For example, there are a number of instances where the Spirit confirmed truth to believers, only to have the truth turn out to be false. For example, the Mormon apostle Paul H. Dunn was well known for giving conference talks about his experiences as a professional baseball player and as a soldier. Many faithful recall his stories and how the Spirit touched them during his talks. Since he neither participated in war, nor was a professional baseball player, the spirit that many felt could not have been testifying about the veracity of his stories. When confronted with Paul H. Dunn, many believers say that in that case, the Spirit was testifying about the truth of his message, or even if the stories themselves weren't true. Sometimes Mormons will say that the Spirit will testify of universal truth, regardless of the religion it is being taught in. This would explain why other Christians can feel the Spirit, because they are teaching of Christ. The problem with these explanations is that there is no quantifiable difference between when the Spirit is testifying about the truth of the message, as in Paul H. Dunn's case, when the Spirit is testifying of universal truth, as in the other Christian churches' cases, or when the Spirit is testifying about the actual truth of the claim, as in praying about the veracity of the Book of Mormon as an actual history of Native Americans. You can't have it all ways. Similar to Paul H. Dunn's stories, the official history of the LDS Church purposely leaves out many facts that, while true, may not be faith-promoting. For example, the use of seer stones by Joseph Smith to translate the Book of Mormon, the nature of polygamy practiced by the early church, etc. The resulting history is not unlike a Disney movie of a historical event, where the story is very touching and sensational but not accurate. Someone who receives this version of events is more likely to be emotionally affected by it and attribute the emotion to the Spirit, but receiving the entire history, with troubling parts and all, may not evoke a spiritual confirmation. It isn't reasonable to suggest that people were not actually affected by Paul H. Dunn's stories or by hearing a whitewashed version of church history. But when we attribute just any good feelings to the Spirit, we can confuse what is actually causing the feelings and what those feelings actually mean. So if it's not the Spirit, what is it? There is a philosophical tool known as Occam's Razor, which paraphrased states that in most cases, the simplest of all explanations is usually correct. Based on Occam's Razor, we should explore some other explanations for the phenomenon known as the Spirit. First of all, we have to define objective truth. Objective truth is what is real, regardless of what anybody's opinion is on the topic. For example, 5 is a greater amount than 3. No matter what I think about it, that is true. A good example of this concept in regards to religion is the belief that the Earth was the center of the universe. When Galileo was led to believe, through scientific investigation, that the Sun was actually the center of the solar system, the religious establishment of his day considered this to be heresy and contrary to God's word. But since the Sun is actually the center of the solar system and not the Earth, eventually the objective truth was discovered. With Paul H. Dunn's stories, the objective truth was that he was never a professional baseball player or a veteran. Feelings can be extremely powerful, without any spiritual involvement. Most of us have been moved to tears by a touching movie or a powerful book. Listening to a ghost story around a campfire can keep you up all night jumping at every sound. The stories can be completely fictitious, yet our emotions can be completely affected by them. If you add in a religious component, wherein the listener not only believes the story to be true, but also believes that the story will actually affect them, the likelihood of being affected by the story is greater. Many people will not watch movies regarding satanic possession because they are afraid that they may actually invite evil spirits by watching the movie, even if the story is completely made up. This emotional response to perceived spiritual experiences is a known physiological phenomenon. It can be predicted and measured, and there have been numerous studies that explore the different variables that make up a powerful emotional connection to a story. In none of these studies does the actual veracity of the story actually affect the emotional connection. What matters is that the subject believes the story. Also, we must take into consideration the idea of confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is the idea that we tend to count the hits and ignore the misses. It is the way psychics convince their marks that their predictions are accurate. By putting out enough vague statements, some are bound to be accurate. When the credulous believer hears the 5 accurate statements from the psychic, they tend to ignore the 20 inaccurate statements. When we pray for divine guidance, anything can be considered an answer to a prayer. For example, if we are behind on our bills and we pray for financial help, and the next day we happen to receive a check that was owed to us, we consider that to be an answer to the prayer. Would the check have arrived anyway? Probably. What if the check didn't arrive? Whatever occurs to make it so you can pay your bills would have been considered a hit. We don't consider the non-arrival of a check to be a miss. The same is true with the Spirit. If we pray about the veracity of the Book of Mormon, almost anything can be considered a hit. If we don't get a vision about its truth, we don't consider that a miss. And when considering the misses of confirmation bias, we are reminded of another basic Mormon belief, that if you didn't receive an answer to your prayer, it is likely because you were either unworthy, didn't ask right, didn't have sincere intentions, or just haven't received the answer yet. With these caveats, there is essentially no way to receive a negative answer to a prayer about the veracity of the Book of Mormon. Confirmation bias, an emotional effect of a story in a controlled environment, conform to what we already know about the world around us, without having to add any supernatural aspects to the equation. These phenomena are entirely consistent with each known variety of spiritual manifestations across all religions. Occam's razor tells us that the mundane answer, and not the supernatural one, is a much more plausible explanation for the feelings of the spirit. How then do we discover truth? A common question that arises with the mundane explanation for the feelings we call the spirit is, how then do we discover truth? When it comes to spiritual matters, we are used to relying on those good feelings to help us make important decisions. If those feelings are self-generated, then how do we know what God wants us to know? For the most part, Mormons, like everyone else, make most of their decisions based off of logic, good evidence, and sound reasoning. When building a shed, most of us consult plans instead of the spirit. When deciding which car to buy, we make objective comparisons, read reviews and criticisms, and see which one best fits our budget. It is really only when it comes to questions that don't have absolute answers, such as, should I take this job, or should we buy this home, that we are truly tempted to consult the spirit. Most of the time, we only consult the spirit after having done all that we can to make an informed decision, and many times the spirit just makes us feel comfortable with the decision that we have already made. Having independent confirmation can make you feel better about a big decision, and conversely, can also take away the responsibility if the choice was unfortunate. If there is a God, and since the Spirit isn't a reliable source of truth, then he apparently wants us to discover the truth about the gospel, in the same manner as he wants us to find out the truth about buying a car, by sincere investigation and careful, well-thought-out decisions. When we put the onus for our decisions on the Spirit, we remove the responsibility to make good decisions from ourselves. When we make bad decisions, we blame the fact that we were led by the Spirit and don't take the proper blame for those decisions ourselves. Additionally, we can become increasingly reliant on following the promptings of the still small voice to the point where our whims become messages from the Spirit. In conclusion, relying on the Spirit to determine truth is unreliable, and there are much more plausible explanations for the feelings that accompany prayer. That isn't to say that prayers don't get answered, only that our interpretation of any associated subjective experience may be wrong, and therefore our convictions to those beliefs should reflect that uncertainty. When confronted with a difficult issue in regards to our beliefs, resorting to the defense of, "the Spirit told me it was true," is an intellectual get-out-of-jail-free card, and is a perfect example of the special pleading logical fallacy. Very nice. It is completely possible that what we felt was real to us, but the conclusions that we are tempted to draw about those experiences are very possibly not accurate.
There are many different areas of the church that give different people problems and crises of faith. We oftentimes speak of the shelf that those ideas go on. Probably one of the leading ideas on the shelf is that of race and the church's relationship to race. Listen to Christian's essay as he discusses his own historical relationship with the idea of race in the Mormon church and how he thinks about those things now.
The first black man I ever met was Karl Malone. Yes, that Karl Malone, the NBA star. It was the fall of 1985, his rookie season with Utah Jazz. I was 14 and a rising 7th grade basketball star at Kaysville Junior High. I had convinced my dad to take me to an open Utah Jazz practice at Westminster College in Salt Lake. Afterward, I got a few autographs, including the mailman's. A few months later, after one of these Kaysville Junior High games, my family celebrated at our favorite restaurant, the Mandarin in Bountiful. There happened to be sitting in the waiting room was Adrian Dantley. I sat next to him and nervously started up a conversation, telling him about my game that day. He seemed, or at least acted, interested, asking me about how many points and rebounds I had. So the first two interactions that I ever had with adult African-American men, if you can call getting an autograph and a 3-minute conversation interactions, were both with NBA superstars. There were only a few black kids at Kaysville Junior High. Vu, a recent immigrant to the U.S. who was a 9th grader and who was also on the basketball team. And there was one other student that I vaguely remember from the 7th grade with me. But my junior high yearbook reveals that there were two. I don't remember the other one. One of them is not in the 8th grade yearbook, and neither of them are in the 9th grade yearbook. There were no black teachers at Kaysville Junior High, nor at Davis High School. No black staff members of any kind. I tell you this to illustrate just how racially undiverse growing up in Kaysville, Utah was. I had a couple of Asian American friends and knew a few Hispanic students, but otherwise all of my friends, classmates, and teachers were white. The two most common points of Mormon doctrine to cause questions among believers are the blacks in the priesthood issue and polygamy. I never had any reason to think about, much less question, either of these. I grew up knowing that I had pioneer and polygamous ancestors, but never gave it much thought. The so-called priesthood ban was lifted when I was 7 years old, before I was even technically a member. Having almost no contact with persons of color, the issue just didn't cross my mind. It didn't even occur to me that growing up, Karl Malone couldn't have even been a deacon. My only interactions with African Americans was with the Cosbys on Thursday nights. Then I moved to New Hampshire between my junior and senior years of high school when my dad took a job near Boston. I went from being in a high school of probably 90% Mormons to being one of only 6 Mormons in a school of about 3,000, and one of those 6 was my sister. Suddenly I was a point of curiosity. I was the new tall kid from Utah. What are Mormons? What do you believe? How are you different from Catholics? Moreover, I now had African-American classmates. I won't say that I had many black friends, but my world now looked decidedly different than it used to. I started to confront these issues. I didn't feel I could talk about them with others, and it didn't occur to me to head to the library. This was 1988, pre-internet days, of course, and I doubt the Nashville Public Library would have had much anyway. I tackled polygamy first. I read the Old Testament and made a note of every time there was a reference to plural marriage. Of course, I had no real biblical studies background other than seminary, which I often skipped at Davis High to go cycling, and Sunday school, which was mostly spent flirting with girls, so I really had no means to interpret what I was reading. I just made a tally, and soon enough I was able to put this issue on the shelf. It didn't cross my mind to wonder if the apostles, or Jesus himself, were polygamous, given that this was supposed to be the restoration of the Church of Christ. But the priesthood ban was trickier. If God was not a respecter of persons and loved all of his children, how was I to make sense of this? The Mormon books I had were mostly silent on this issue, other than Bruce R. McConkie's unhelpful Mormon doctrine, which mostly just repeats the official declaration, too. I didn't know that dialogue existed, let alone Lester Bush's article or others to help me make sense of the issue. And I didn't connect the dots that the Book of Mormon teaches that whitesome is delightsome, while darkness is a sign of wickedness. None of my friends asked me about it, probably because they didn't themselves know about it. But if they had, how would I have explained that only 10 years earlier my black classmates would have only been allowed marginal membership in the LDS Church had they been interested in joining? Then came Elder Van Dyke to the Nashville ward. He was the answer to my prayers because, as you might guess, Elder Van Dyke was black. He was one of the friendliest, most energetic missionaries I had met. I had not interacted with missionaries in Utah. You could count all of the non-member houses within our ward boundaries on one hand. So it was exciting for me to spend time with the missionaries. One time, while out on splits, I asked Elder Van Dyke if I could ask him a question. Of course, he replied. I think he knew what was coming. I suddenly became nervous and didn't even know how to ask. So finally, I just asked what he thought of Declaration 2. He explained that he had faith that the Lord knew what he was doing, and he didn't worry about it. Well, that was enough for me. If it didn't worry him, why should it worry me? A year later, I would be in the MTC at the same time that the first black general authority, Helvesio Martins, was there to learn English. And I had the chance to speak with him a few times. This further reassured me that I had nothing to worry about. The priesthood ban would go to the back burner for some time for me. During my mission to Santiago, Chile, I learned of the racism toward Mapuche Indians, but they would have never been excluded from the priesthood anyway, and there were no blacks in Chile. When I returned to college at the University of Utah, my dorm floors had international students, but very few black students. But later, as other doubts about the church came up for me, I revisited the priesthood ban. The same questions that nagged me before came back, and it came off the shelf. I distinctly remember a conversation I had with an old college friend about the topic. He was active in the church, just like me, but he was unequivocal. It was wrong. Wrong. It was just a mistake. This seemed like not a small mistake for the one true church to have. It was only then that I began to learn about the origins of the ban, as I began to try to make sense of it. I encountered the quotes by Brigham Young that the Negro is damned, and that if the white man mixes with the seed of Cain, the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot. I dismissed this as being from a long bygone era, then only to discover the more recent attitudes of Ezra Taft Benson and other general authorities toward Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. Utah didn't even use the MLK designation for the national holiday, instead calling it Human Rights Day until 2000. And it was even more recent that the state finally changed its constitution so that the legislature did not open on MLK Day. Last year, after Barack Obama was sworn in as president, he attended a luncheon with U.S. senators in the Statuary Hall of the U.S. Capitol. As I watched this event on TV, I noticed the statue of Brigham Young in the background. And then there was a scene of two prominent Mormon senators toasting, with glasses of water, of course, our first black president. This, to me, seemed like a curious moment. I have now lived in South Carolina for the past 3 years, where the issue of race is ever present. As I look back on my youth in Utah, I can understand and even perhaps empathize a bit with why the priesthood ban stood for so long. If I had such limited exposure to African Americans in the 1970s and 80s, how much less exposure must there have been in previous decades? This does not excuse the behavior of past church leaders. It only helps me understand how they, as humans, might make the kinds of decisions that they did in leading their organization. Just a few weeks ago, I happened to be fooling around on Family Search, a habit that must be drilled into my Mormon DNA, and started looking into one line of my family that I didn't know much about. I kept going back and back and discovered they had lived in Camden, South Carolina, just 15 miles from where I currently live. This was on a Friday night. 2 days later, I spent Sunday afternoon at the Camden Historical Society, curious to see what I could find about my ancestors. It turns out that my family had come from England to Pennsylvania, and then they'd moved to South Carolina in the early 18th century. And 100 years later, they were off to Alabama, where they converted to Mormonism, and headed to Council Bluffs, and then across to Zion. My direct ancestor was a certain John Rutledge, and no, not the early South Carolina governor and second Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but apparently he was distantly related. These facts were easy to digest, but others were not. From the minute I learned that I had ancestors in South Carolina, I had a sinking feeling. That feeling was confirmed when I found that John Rutledge Sr.'s will of 1803, in which he bequeathed, and I quote, "one Negro woman named Millie and one Negro boy named Sam, and their increase," end quote, to his wife. Apparently he was fairly wealthy, as his will stipulates the fortunes of quite a few slaves and other property. So here I was sitting in the Camden archives looking at this will. I had grown up with virtually no contact with blacks, and now had the disquieting realization that my direct ancestors had been slave owners. I, of course, had no role in my ancestors' decisions to enter into polygamy, and I had no role in these newly found ancestors' decisions to buy and sell African men and women as property. But I can decide what I will do from here on out. Since moving to the South, I've had the opportunity to spend time at the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, Alabama, where I could see the bombed-out Freedom Rider bus and touch the bars of the jail cell from which King wrote his famous letter from Birmingham. I've been to the MLK National Historic Site in Atlanta, where I've seen where King grew up and where he worked. I can decide what I will do now with this information and how my past experiences can help shape what I do, how I will teach my students and my kids about love, respect, and acceptance. And this is my Mormon expression.
And for our final essay, for part one, you'll recall at the beginning that I said we didn't put much of any rules on this, and I'm glad, because here we have an entry that is a song. Listen as Richard attempts to process the words of Joseph Smith and those of Gordon B. Hinckley to something they would both probably find disagreeable.
This church takes the position that we will abide by the law. We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, magistrates, in honoring, obeying, and sustaining the law.
Was Emma proud, selfish, greedy, hurt, or all of the above when Joseph kept the truth from her as he fell secretly in love? Was Fanny Alger at 16 an ideal choice as plural wife? Did Joseph really see an angel with a sword thread in his eye? Was Emma lying about seeing the transaction in the bar? Or was it William McClellan having fun who spun the yarn when Oliver called it dirty, nasty, filthy affair? Was he excommunicated to keep the saints unaware? Was Fanny Alger at 16 an ideal choice as plural wife? Did Joseph really see an angel with a sword threat in his
eye? I condemn it, yes, as a practice, because I think it is not doctrinal, it is not legal, and this church takes the position that we will abide by the law. I still believe that right is right and wrong is wrong. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. It is not doctrinal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. I still believe that right is right and wrong is wrong.
life of a saint, according to Joseph Smith. When the law's after you, what you gonna do?
Never trust the law, don't trust the law.
You run! What about sustaining the law?
No way!
Even with the war in for arrest. When asked about your wife,
I can only find one.
La 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 la, doody-dee, doody-doo. When you want a new girl,
I'll take her.
If she disagrees,
tell her about an angel with a sword.
What if she exposes you?
Excommunicate.
But revelations don't
fail. Some revelations are of the devil.
La 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 la, doody-dee, doody-doo. Wife want you alone,
I take her.
If she begs you to be faithful,
promise you are.
If your followers accuse you
of what?
Of living unchaste behavior,
make communicate.
Tra la 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 la, doody-dee, doody-doo. Can you see things through a stone?
You bet.
Can you translate from papyrus?
Better than any professor.
What do hieroglyphics say?
That's the handwriting of Abraham, father of the faith.
And how about this?
That's the autograph of Moses.
Don't forget you need some money.
Gentlemen, those who see these curiosities generally pay my mother a quarter of a dollar.
La la la, money, zippity-doo-dee-doo. So what about freedom of the press?
I'm all for it.
What if it exposes you?
Excommunicate.
And prints the truth about you?
Burn the press down.
But isn't that illegal?
I am the prophet, mayor, general, and judge.
And that's against the law.
Not with a writ of habeas corpus.
Look at you now, you know.
If I were to tell you all I knew of the kingdom of God, I do know that you would rise up and kill me.
La 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 la, do do do. What?
Huh?
Man, don't say that.
Why
do you say that?
What do you mean? I thought it was good. It sounded prophetic.
Yeah, but now you're gonna die.
I might not die. It could mean that I just won't tell him everything.
All eyes are on us.